It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In April, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto announced creation of a social benefits fund or urban wealth fund to achieve the goal of the One Pittsburgh Resilience Strategy to tackle the big challenges facing the city. We're in the mayor's office today to get an update. Mayor Peduto, welcome to the confluence.
Thanks, Kevin.
Earlier this summer, you told me that you wanted to release details of the One Pittsburgh plan for the public to see sometime in September. So are you ready to do so?
We have a draft. The draft still needs to go through one more final edit before it's ready to be released. If not by the end of September, by early to mid-October. At this point, we're pretty much done with the details of what the specific programs are that are being addressed over a 12-year period.
You had said it would be a huge document, but at its heart, really, what is it?
I think it's 130 pages, so it is pretty big. The idea was we have a lot of reports that have been done over the past 5 years. A culmination of looking at those reports found that there are critical needs of this city that if left unaddressed or without some proactive activity will create greater disparity within the future of Pittsburgh, and disparity being one of the single stresses that could have an adverse effect on the city's future. We looked at our environment and our infrastructure, and in areas where we're woefully behind, where we could partner with nonprofits and institutions and other organizations in order to be able to do more than play catch up, but have a 12-year plan that would put in green infrastructure and enhance the city's environment. And so we put all of this together under one plan, looked at it under basically nine different major categories, and put a price tag on it and said, what will it cost? What is the amount of city money that we can invest in it? Who are our partners in government that could also be investors in it? And then what would be the role of our large nonprofit institutions, our corporate community, our foundation community, and our nonprofit community to partner in a way to get it all done? And now we're looking at a price tag of approximately $4 billion of spending over 12 years that will be able to address the concerns of this city, much in the same way that we did back in the 1940s and the 50s when we took on the issues under Mayor Lawrence of air quality and water quality and flooding and transformation from an industrial city to a corporate city. And that's really where we are at this point.
You mentioned government partners. Within the city or other levels of government are you talking about?
Every level of government. So there is a critical need as we're looking at dealing with our combined sewer overflow problem, that we're not just building big pipes, but where Alcosan is a partner with PWSA in creating green infrastructure, areas in the city where when it rains in these now almost every year, 50-year rains, the water never has to go to a pipe because it's retained in a natural area. And every level, from state level to federal level, county level, to local authority level, we want to be able to harness what we're doing on a 12-year basis and to work together towards reaching those goals.
I remember when you announced this plan, you talked about addressing homelessness, hunger, affordable housing, the need for universal pre-K. Over the months, has that actually expanded other needs, other areas of concern?
We're not looking to create another layer of government. What we want to be able to do is empower those that are already working on these issues to do more. So what can Just Harvest and the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank and 412 Food Rescue do to address hunger in the city? And then how do we get to a point where no child, no senior goes to bed hungry? The idea that we can eradicate homelessness, we realize that homelessness is a chronic problem. But when you look at what we've been able to do with homeless vets, taking over 400 homeless vets off the streets and finding them homes. We know that if we have an all-weather shelter that could work all four seasons, 12 months a year, that would be able to house approximately 400 people, and while they're in the shelter, helping them to transition to housing, we can greatly reduce the number of homeless people within the city. And with affordable housing, we have already created a trust fund, thanks to a courageous vote of city council to raise taxes, that is putting $10 million a year into affordable housing initiatives. Imagine if we can match that with corporate, foundation, nonprofit dollars, so that it's $20 million a year. And how many more families would be able to not have to worry about Pittsburgh becoming successful, but would be a part of that success? These are the critical issues that will either determine whether we have a successful Pittsburgh for some or a successful Pittsburgh for all over the next decade.
So let's talk finances. You said $4 billion over 12 years. You told me earlier that once this plan was in place, revealed, you intended to become the fundraiser-in-chief. So have you begun your pitches to corporations, foundations, major nonprofits? You getting nibbles, commitments?
Well, this whole idea of creating a one PGH plan for Pittsburgh was based on the conversations that we've had over the past few years with the large nonprofits, UPMC, Carnegie Mellon, University of Pittsburgh, Allegheny Health Networks, Allegheny West Penn. And what we are doing is responding to what their concerns were. They were not interested in supporting a pilot that would just go into a city budget.
Payment in lieu of taxes.
Payment in lieu of taxes that would just go into a city budget. They wanted to combine mission, where they're looking at ways that they can be partners in helping Pittsburgh to be successful at the same time, looking at what the critical needs of the city are. They wanted a sunset, something that would start at a certain date, end at a certain date, and during that discussion talk about what the needs would be for the next decade of the city's future. We've since reached out to the foundation community and to the corporate community. And when we announce this, we want it to be, just as the name says, one PGH. We want to be able to show that it has cross-section support. But the fundraising goals won't just be one and done. It will be something that will be ongoing for the lifetime of this organization. We have reached out to the Sprout Fund, which is sunsetting at the end of September. We are now working with law and finance organizations in order to help us to transition the Sprout Fund into the One PGH Fund, and the future of the Sprout Fund taking hold and then expanding into this new organization.
Have you got dollar commitments toward that $4 billion at this point?
No, I don't want to make it seem that the commitments and the documents are signed and everything is finalized. What we've had are conversations on the amounts needed. How much do we need from our hospitals in the city of Pittsburgh? How much do we need from our universities? Even beyond Carnegie Mellon and Pitt, we need their work with the Pittsburgh Council of Higher Education to have Duquesne and Point Park and Carlow and Chatham all a part of this. What do we need in order to reach our goals from our foundation community, and what do we need from our corporate community? Dividing that out and then determining how much individual organizations will contribute will be something that I hope to have not finalized, but at least in good structure by the end of this year, and then ongoing continuously for the next 12 years.
Are you finding that as you have these initial conversations, there's more of an appetite for that bigger picture, actually more dollars, a larger contribution, but going for maybe toward a vision, toward structured assistance, if you would, than to smaller payments, payment in lieu of taxes, as you mentioned, just for to kick into the operating budget?
That's a really good way of putting it. So the idea is, what happens if we work together and try to accomplish really big goals as compared to What if we're able to buy two additional fire trucks in the 2020 budget? The idea is that if we can create a model that shows how Pittsburgh's success has always been, which is partnerships. Pittsburgh is a city that is studied for its partnerships. If we can show that model in a 21st century way of how those partnerships can address the investment into people, into infrastructure, and into environment, I think that this becomes a model for many 21st century cities. We can't rely upon Washington. I mean, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. Washington has very little discretionary funds in order to be able to do the types of things that we need done. We can't rely upon Harrisburg. Again, there's very little money that is coming back on a local level. We have to be able to solve these problems on our own. We've got to roll up our sleeves. We've got to work as one city, and we have to address the issues that are providing the greatest stresses and the greatest shocks to our system. And we see it on a daily basis. We see our infrastructure crumbling. We have to invest back into our infrastructure. We see the need of increasing our investment in our environment and the benefit that has come over 50 years of that investment. And we realize that our people have an opportunity to be a part of this new economy, but only if we provide the opportunity to train them for that, starting at 3 years old and all the way through a lifetime.
You mentioned the impact of these challenges on the future, but they're also impacting the present. Are you sort of impatient to get this thing really rolling?
So I first of all have to recognize that fire truck that just went by after I said we could buy two more fire trucks. I think they heard me. Secondly, I'm always impatient. That's probably one of my worst faults, is that I want things to be done now. But at the same time, we're trying to build a foundation that will go beyond the days that I work in this office. I want to be able to hand off to the next mayor this city that is on solid financial ground, that has the investments occurring beyond its operating and capital budgets to be able to take care of the greatest needs, but also realizing that 12 years from now, the needs in the city are going to be vastly different, and leaving the flexibility there for the next administration and the administration after that to have the same ability to create an organization to be able to address their needs.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris, still ahead on The Confluence. From meditation to exercise, people turn to yoga for all manner of calm. But for survivors of physical trauma, your typical studio might be emotionally triggering. We take you inside a class for yogis, all inspired to be better advocates for their practitioners. A prestigious art and performance festival is back in town, and we'll go climbing with one of the world's most famous professionals. Pittsburgh is gearing up for its first ever professional climbing competition at One Southside Gym. Find those stories, conversations, and more on our website at WESA.FM or wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The majority of natural gas pipelines in Pennsylvania aren't easy to find for most of the public, including the one that exploded in Beaver County recently. Of the roughly 90,000 miles of pipeline in the state, only about 10,000 are on public maps, or 11%. And this week, the judge presiding over East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld's homicide case recused himself after it surfaced he commented on the case on a local TV show prior to being assigned to it. The new judge assigned to the case issued a gag order. Get more top stories by signing up for our daily newsletter at WESA.FM/inbox edition.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 4th Pittsburgh International Festival First gets underway this weekend, today, in Pittsburgh. Let's find out about the highlights, the must-sees and do's with WESA's arts and culture reporter, Bill O'Driscoll. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, Bill, as I said, the 4th Festival, the last one, 2013, everybody remembers that because of this giant yellow duck.
Right, that took over the rivers for a few months, right?
So what's going to be the memorable thing for this festival first?
Well, it looks like there'll be a few things. We can probably start with just the first weekend. There's nothing quite as splashy as the hypertrophy bath toy floating down the rivers. We won't get anything quite like that, I don't think, spectacle-wise, but there's a couple interesting things happening this weekend, for instance, starting it off. This spreads out over 8 weeks, by the way. There's 30 different troops or artists from 20 different countries, truly from all over the world, and there's something going on every week, if not every day. Big thing this week, this weekend, there's a project called Manifold. It's a 3D projection on the face of the Benedum Center with live music played by local musicians, and it's kind of like a big, it is a bit of a spectacle. That's just Friday and Saturday night this week, so that's totally free. It's public art.
How many of these are premieres? Are they premieres to Pittsburgh, the region, what?
They're at least premieres to the region, but many of them are actually North American premieres and even world premieres.
All these works in theater, visual art, music, dance. So we know it's bigger than ever by the length of the festival. Any sense of it's going to be better than ever? Or is that a wait and see?
Well, that's pretty subjective, but a lot of this looks like really cool stuff, I would say. A couple examples I'll give. There's a Brazilian dance troupe called Deborah Coker Dance. And she was actually the choreographer who did the dance spectacle at the Rio Olympics in 2016. Oh. So people might be familiar with her work. This is a stage work that she's doing. And that, you know, I've seen some photos, like production photos of it. It looks pretty spectacular.
These are venues throughout the downtown area? Is that how they work?
Correct. Like the Byam Theater. The visual art is at the galleries people would know, like the August Wilson Center, Space Gallery, Wood Street Galleries. They're using like just, you know, performance venues down all downtown that people will be familiar with.
How is this all put together? 30 companies, 20 different countries, you said. How is it all brought together to come to our city?
Well, they have the Cultural Trust does this. They put it together. That's why, you know, the last one was 5 years ago. It takes a long time to gear up for it, to kind of do the research. The Cultural Trust had a producer. They had some curators. One of the curators actually is Carla Boos, who people might know as the artistic director of Quantum Theater. And there's a producer named Scott Schiller. And they just, you know, spend their time traveling in many cases, kind of searching the globe, you know, for these acts.
Final question to you, Bill. A must see, a must do for Bill O'Driscoll.
Let's see. There's actually a visual art show that looks really cool. It's Nigerian artist named Peju Alatiche, and she has a installation called Flying Girls. It's like a sculptural installation. It's going to be at the August Wilson Center. It's the North American premiere of this. It looks really great.
All right. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Thanks so much, Bill.
You're welcome, Kevin.
The Pittsburgh International Festival of Firsts starts today, runs through November 11th. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. In addition to exercise, many people turn to yoga to improve their mind-body connection. But for survivors of physical trauma, typical yoga studio practices might be emotionally triggering. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden attended a class for yoga teachers who want to learn how to better care for these students.
A group of yoga instructors gathers on a third-floor studio that overlooks Carson Street.
You're welcome to bring your feet hip-width apart and to...
Today, these yogis are the students. They're here to learn a non-coercive instruction style called trauma-informed yoga.
And maybe even notice how the sensation of pressure shifts.
Workshop attendee Lindsay Sculler teaches yoga in Wheeling, West Virginia at the Florence Crinton Institute, which houses girls who have been removed from their homes. Many are survivors of sexual abuse. Sculler says she wants to learn tools to help students build healthy relationships with their bodies.
To discover what they like, what they don't like, what they want, what they need, to tune back into their body since they've had to become so disconnected for survival.
While you may think of yoga as calming and meditative, it can sometimes be the opposite. Instructors tell students when and how to pose. It's also common for them to touch students' bodies without asking to correct their form.
In a lot of yoga teacher training programs, we are taught how to place our hands on someone, but maybe not so much how to be sensitive about, well, does this person want to be touched, and how do we incorporate consent?
Elizabeth Haberer, a yoga instructor and licensed psychotherapist, developed a trauma-informed yoga curriculum, which includes no touching. She also avoids poses that might make students feel vulnerable, especially those where the pelvis or stomach are exposed.
And then on your exhale, maybe bring your hands to heart center.
And instead of telling students how to move, Haberer uses what she calls invitational language. Instructions are suggestions. This helps students feel ownership of their bodies.
You decide your own rhythm based on how long you want your inhales and exhales to be.
Haberer recommends that studios hold regular trauma-informed yoga classes because sexual violence is so pervasive. For example, 2017's National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey found that 1 in 3 women and nearly 1 in 6 men in the U.S. experienced some sort of physical sexual violence in their lifetimes. For this reason, workshop attendee Helen Howe of the Mon Valley wants to incorporate what she's learned into her routine teaching practices.
I teach mostly for companies, and I never realized a particular student in your class may have trauma issues as opposed to teaching a whole class that is brought together for that purpose. So this has been enlightening for me.
In addition to classes, Haberer also does one-on-one trauma-informed yoga therapy at her Houston, Texas studio. Family law attorney Erin Putman is a survivor of domestic violence. She says her emotional pain often manifests as physical tension.
It's a lot to hold in. There's a lot of shame that goes with being a victim of domestic abuse or sexual abuse or anything like that.
Putman says she recently had her first session with Haberer on the advice of her regular therapist. It's more relaxed than other types of mental health treatment.
We've just had on yoga clothes. I had on, yoga clothes, and it's almost like two friends just sitting down and discussing something, except, one is a licensed professional.
The physical abuse from her ex precipitated a period of heavy drinking for Putman. So one of the appealing aspects of trauma-informed yoga is that it's a combination of counseling and exercise. Putman says as she gets stronger physically, she'll also get stronger mentally. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Technical rock climbing jumped on the U.S. scene as early as the late 1800s, but it took nearly 100 years before advances in ropes and climbing aids helped bring it into the mainstream. In recent years, sport climbing and sport climbing gyms have exploded, and starting in 2020, the sport will be recognized for the first time on the world stage as an Olympic event. 90.5 WESA's Megan Harris spoke to two big climbing proponents. She begins with professional climber Tommy Caldwell, who completed one of the toughest routes in the world this year after years of throwing himself at the rock.
The number one thing by far that local climbers suggested I ask you about was training. How does Tommy Caldwell train?
Yeah, wow, that's great. Everybody wants to know about training these days.
We are just the conduit for the question.
Yeah, no, I do, but it's a modern question. People didn't used to care about training that much. I guess that's the difference. People care about training. I care about training. I spent a lot of years trying to get better at climbing big walls by just going climbing on big walls. And I got pretty good, but for me to really be my best, I had to sort of draw inspiration from comp climbers and the younger generation and these people that are kind of like aspiring to be Olympians. And so I changed my training a bit. I started going indoors, hanging on hang boards with stopwatches, watching my diet, eating more plant-based diet. Just got way more scientific about it. And whereas I used to climb probably 5 days a week, like 8 hours a day, I actually climb way less now, but way more intensely. And then I try and sleep more. I don't know. I just kind of reeled in my program a bit.
Do you still prefer climbing outside?
In terms of training?
Yeah.
I think I love just like the outdoor environment. So finding the joy in being outside, like you have to really get obsessed over the data in a way. And for me, that was a bit of an adjustment because I'm usually obsessed by, going out and being in these beautiful places and hanging out with friends. So It feels, I mean, just the whole culture of climbing has changed so much in that way. It's like training, what used to be a bad word, kind of.
Not anymore, especially if you're going to try to distinguish yourself in a particular style of climbing, right? If you're going to try to be an elite.
Yeah, I mean, the big hot topic right now in terms of the change of climbing is the Olympics, because it's a new thing. And so, yeah, people are speed climbing for the first time, but that's almost that's just because of the Olympics. Most climbers, when that announcement happened that speed climbing was part of Olympics, they're like, oh, that's a bummer. That's too bad, because that's not actually what we as climbers do generally, although we're just talking about speed climbing on the Nosevel cap.
Yeah, the nose. Right, the nose climb. That's a climbing route on El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. You and a buddy set the speed record for that this summer.
Yeah. It's not really anything that I aspired to do ever, but I've got a good friend, one of my favorite climbing partners, Alex Honnold. He's really into it. And he asked if I would basically help him break the speed record on the nose, because that's like, it's like the coolest race you can do. You race up, you know, climbing center stage El Capitan as fast as you can. In stark contrast to my last ascent that I did of El Cap, which was 19 days, so.
Which was also a record. Everyone can check out Tommy Caldwell and his climbing partner Kevin Jorgensen's historic ascent of the Don Wall in a movie by the same name. We've been dancing around it a little bit. The Olympics. 2020 will be the first year climbing is recognized as an official Olympic sport. Three disciplines, men and women. Do you plan to compete?
No, I'm not that good.
At least you'll probably know a few of the folks who are competing.
Oh, I mean, I know a lot of them for sure. You know, we're still at the high end of climbing. It's still a relatively small community, so we all know each other. But I guess I'm rooting for Ashima for sure. She's a New Yorker, Japanese girl that weighs like 80 pounds. Super, super amazing climber.
That's Ashima Shirase. She's 17 years old.
Yeah, yeah, really cool. And then I'm decent friends with this guy Alex Megos, who's a German phenom that I've gotten to hang out with. Super jovial guy, but probably more scientific about training than just about anybody. So yeah, those would be the two. And Adam Andra, I mean, everybody in the climbing world knows who Adam Andra is, and he's, you know, he's dominated every form of rock climbing. So in a way, it's kind of like he's the king, and it would be cool to see the king keep his crown in the Olympics. Yeah.
Speaking of famous friends, you were among several climbers who went to Capitol Hill this year to talk about access to public land. What was the goal of that trip?
I mean, Bears Ears has been the big push. It's scary to me, not only because, I mean, in a way it became a monument and then that status just got taken back away, so it's no different. But what people don't realize is that all these oil and gas leases that weren't accessible now they are accessible.
Bears Ears, that was the 1.3 million acre area in southeastern Utah, designated a national monument by President Obama. President Trump has since rescinded that.
Yep, yep.
And just a little more context, oil and gas leases were non-starters as long as the canyons were federally protected. Last December, the Trump administration reduced the size of two national monuments by about 2 million acres. So only about 15% of Bears Ears remains intact, and it cut the nearby Grand Staircase Escalante in half. So their status is still up in the air, but they're a lot smaller and potentially open to the energy sector.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a good chance that in the next decade there'll be oil rigs at the, you know, at the rim of Indian Creek Canyon, which would completely change the atmosphere of that place. Everybody goes there because it's remote. It feels, it's just got this like almost holy feel to it. And if you put an oil rig right at the rim, it's not going to be that way anymore. So I'm worried about that. But I think more generally the Antiquities Act, that's the act that Roosevelt signed in that allowed any president to sign into protection lands, to protect it. And Trump was the first one who reversed that, basically. But I hate the idea that you can take away public lands, because once Bears Ears gets taken away, who knows what's next.
Right. So, Tommy, no offense, but professional climbers weren't always hip enough to head down to Washington with much fanfare. What does it feel like now to wield that kind of political influence as you've grown into the sport?
I mean, I think it's kind of cool that we as climbers can come to D.C. and represent a group that is large enough now and has enough financial backing that the politicians will listen to us. And, you know, we believe in our causes of protecting public lands and, you know, things like that. And so it's cool to have these things that are dear to you and to work to protect them. I mean, I think that's why we're doing it. And it seems effective. Like when you go to DC as a climber, the senators and the congressmen and the staffers actually take the meetings because they want to hang out with climbers. And you get them to sign on to bills. You're sitting there in the office. They commit to signing on to bills. It actually, makes a difference.
One of the women professional climbers who was with you in D.C., Sasha DeJulian, came forward this year describing some pretty intense bullying by another sponsored pro, Joe Kinder.
That was a crazy thing that went down in the climbing world.
As I understand it, you weren't involved, but do you feel like you have a role to play in terms of preventing an atmosphere that could lead to something like that?
I mean, I'm definitely a huge advocate for the Me Too movement. I think it's making the world a better place. What Sasha did was absolutely bold and heroic in so many ways. The other side of it is, like, Joe, I know that guy, and he's not all bad, you know, he's a good guy too. So, you know, it's sad in that way.
Are there any unique lessons to be gleaned from this? I mean, for the climbing community?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, my experience with climbers is that they are less crass and kind of like, they're less that way than most groups of people in general. So, most groups of men in general, like the men, like the gnarly men in climbing are actually pretty good guys for the most part. But every group of people can do better. And so I think that whole mute too, like I said, I'm a fan of it. And I think the fact that it came into climbing in this way is not surprising. And it's a great thing.
Speaking of the evolution of the sport, you are getting older.
Yeah.
What do you expect to see from young people and kids picking up climbing today?
I mean, there's just so many more climbers getting started right now because of the climbing gyms everywhere. And that's just accessing this gene pool. And so these talents are coming out in this way that never did in the past. And the training is being more refined. And so the standards in the gym, mostly right now, are being pushed unbelievably. And I think that is going to bleed itself to all the other disciplines. Like some of those gym climbers will become free soloists like Alex Honnold. Some of them will become alpine climbers. Some of them will become sport climbers. Some of them will become boulders. And so I bet in the next decade, we're going to see sort of the trajectory of the high end just skyrocket. It's going to be really cool.
Right. Climbing competitions have changed a lot since some of the events you describe in your book that came out late last year. Some of the routes require these long reaches or super dynamic leaps. Do you think that bodes well for the popularity of the sport?
I think it does, yeah. I mean, it is more crowd-pleasing, but it's also more fun. Like, when I used to do competitions, they were just like mini routes where you just climbed until you got too tired and you fell off, but the moves weren't especially interesting. And now there are these big, these weird puzzles that you solve and these gymnastic moves, and it's real fun to go into a gym and you know, you end up doing all these crazy moves that, you know, you'll be climbing a group of people and somebody will finally unlock the sequence and it'll work. And it's so exciting compared to just getting pumped and falling off, which is what it used to be.
Tommy Caldwell is a professional climber and author. A film documenting his nearly decade-long chase to make it up what is arguably the longest, hardest climb in the world, the Dawn Wall, debuted last week. Tommy, thank you for talking to The Confluence.
Yeah, for sure.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. This weekend, Pittsburgh's newest climbing gym is hosting the city's first ever professional competition. The USA Climbing-sponsored event kicks off today at Ascend. I popped down to the Southside Gym this week to talk to co-owner Paul Garino and get a peek at what spectators can expect this weekend. So what am I seeing here?
So right now we've got a team of 8 route setters. They just finished setting the finals problems, which will be for Saturday night for the top competitors for the National Cup Series. That's very exciting. And they're also working on putting up, I think, about 80 problems total to serve the youth competition and the citizens competition as well.
For somebody who's never seen it before, what does route setting look like?
We have what we call a bouldering wall. It's about 15 feet tall, various angles. There is a sea of padding underneath it. And the route setters use different shapes and sizes and colors of climbing holds, we call them, grips, and they put them on the wall kind of however they want to force certain moves to get the climbers to the top, you know, following a particular path under a certain level of difficulty.
So, Paul, what can we expect from the competition itself?
This is a pretty unique event. It's called the Steel Town Throwdown, which is the name for our in-house competitions that we host here. This event's a little bit different because we're partnering with USA Climbing. So we're bringing in some pro-level adult competitors, as well as hosting a local youth competition, all centered around bouldering, which is a style of climbing that we specialize in here.
The gym always has routes up for customers, but those all came down this week. How does competition route setting differ from what Pittsburghers would usually see in the gym?
Right, good question. So, you know, typically when our gym's open and we're setting commercial climbs, we're setting for a wide range of people. So there's a wide variety and styles of climbs that are pretty accessible for beginners up to elite climbers. When there's a competition, though, there's a large emphasis placed on what the spectators will get out of it. So the route setters tend to favor bigger moves, jumps, we call it dynamic movement, things that are gonna be a little bit more exciting, not only for the climbers, but for the spectators to really rally, get behind.
Do we have any locals competing or professionals traveling in from out of town?
Yeah, so this event will bring in some of the country's strongest competitors, some big names coming in, which we're excited to have in Pittsburgh. But we do have some local heroes that we think we're going to give them a run for their money. So it's going to be really cool to see that mashup.
What is it like for someone who's never seen a climbing competition? You're talking about some of those big reaches, big moves. But what is it? What's there for someone who's watching the event only?
You know, a lot of this has to do with the Olympics, including climbing in 2020. So some of the competitive formats have adopted this more dynamic and explosive climbing movement. And so what that does is it really gives the spectators, those that are familiar with climbing and those that have no idea what they're looking at, something really either fun or and exciting to see. What we hope that the spectators can provide is just a lot of enthusiasm for the competitors. They appreciate a lot of cheering. There's gonna be some close calls, some head-to-head races, and you know, we'll do our best to keep the spectators as informed as possible so they, you know, can really truly understand what's happening and get behind it.
So for the professionals that are coming in, are they gonna make it look so easy that I think I can do it?
Yeah, they might actually. And that's another reason that the competition setting is this different style, is that, you know, if a professional climber is grabbing, you know, seemingly easy or big holds, anyone might say, this is kind of boring, I don't understand, or it looks like I could do that. But when they're jumping and catching holds at big distances and contorting their bodies in pretty unique ways, it's pretty obvious to see that it's definitely an elite level climber. So.
And this competition, there are levels to this, right? So this is a Pittsburgh competition, but what does that lead to? Regional, national?
Right, so this is a part of what's called the USA Climbing National Cup Series. And there are four events around the country. Pittsburgh is one of them this fall. And I believe in either December or January, there will be the finals round. I believe you have to compete in one of the National Cup Series to be invited to then compete in the finals round later in the year.
And you mentioned the Olympics. Obviously, Ascend and Pittsburgh are pretty far removed from that. But what does it mean to you as a small business owner to have your venue associated with something that is on such a prestigious stage?
Right. It's really exciting that climbing, obviously, is in the Olympics now. What that means for Ascend in Pittsburgh and then a lot of gyms around the country and the world is that we have a lot of catching up to do. I think we're starting with our youth programming, thinking that a lot of these, you know, kids are going to grow up and be competing in the Olympics in 2 years from now, 6 years from now. So we're trying to design a competitive program for youths and for adults to start to understand what competing on an international level is all about. Arguably, Europe is ahead of the curve, and so we have a little bit of work to do. That's not to say that America doesn't have some really talented climbers, but on average, we've got some catching up to do.
Paul Garino is the co-owner of the Southside-based climbing gym Ascend. They're hosting the city's first professional climbing competition today and tomorrow. Paul, thanks so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
That's 90.5 WESA's Megan Harris. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, the city could soon have its fourth needle exchange site, this one in Carrick, known as Ground Zero for drug overdoses. And they're trained to track down suspects, but they're also invaluable in finding missing persons. We'll meet the man who oversees the Pittsburgh Police K-9 unit. Today's program was engineered by Katie Blackley. The assistant producer is Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.